Reverend Cooper Realto.
In some ways, the change of weather, I think, reflected the change of our mood. The weather became greyer and colder, and for us, it accompanied the realisation that we were going to have to go ashore, we were going to have to fight, and that it might not be very pleasant. We became interested. The ship there was a map on which the course of the ship was shown daily, and this was placed in a fairly popular area on the ship, so soldiers could see where we were. It was very interesting. About this time, no further entries were put on the map. Now, whether that was because the person doing it had got other things to do, or whether it was a deliberate policy, I don't know. I suspect the former. I don't think there was any deliberate plan to keep it in the dark. But I'd found on the upper deck anyway, there was a repeater compass, and we could see quite clearly the course the ship was sailing. But we did seem to be spending a lot of time just messing around in the South Atlantic. Now, whether that was for political reasons, whether that was for military reasons, I never established. But I was aware that we certainly weren't taking a direct course to the island, nor were we getting there as fast as we could in the 2 or 3 days before we landed. Eventually, we knew the plan. We knew that we would be landing as a battalion first, and that our task was to head towards the Sussex Mountains and occupy those mountains and defend the anchorage from what was thought to be the Argentine Mobile Reserve at Goose Green. We'd had some paper exercises, since H joined us at Ascension Island, and quite clearly he then had a good idea of what Julian Thompson had in mind. And our exercises, with hindsight, did reflect a number of the tactical requirements that Julian Thompson had obviously put across to H. He had a daily O group in the week or so before we landed, to which I went, and really during the course of those orders groups, the plan became more and more apparent, though for us it was quite simple: get onshore, get to Sussex Mountain, dig in, and stop anything coming over the hill and into the anchorage. We were put on reverse slopes, and it really looked fairly straightforward. The unknown parts were whether we'd be opposed in our landing, whether what our resupply would be, and what kind of reception we might expect from the Argentine Air Force and ground forces. When we, on the 24 hours before landing, at the time I was only aware that we didn't seem to know what was going on, and I subsequently discovered that in fact our decoding machine on the ship had broken down, and that the signal telling us the actual hour and day of landing had reached everybody in the fleet except us on the Norland. That was rectified when Broadsword came alongside and fired a line and passed a copy of the orders over in presumably a waterproof bag. And that's when we discovered that night was the night that we were landing. That gave us time to draw the remainder of our ammunition and things like the fuses for the hand grenades and so on, and to arm these various weapons, and just to prepare ourselves, finally. My final preparation took several forms, not least of all equipping myself with a flask of coffee to take ashore. I scrounged a couple of pints of milk, so a pasteurised milk from the galley. I also tried to get a bottle of whiskey. I thought it was quite funny, really. I always carried a hip flask of whiskey around with me. Really, it's a bit of an icebreaker with troops. Soldiers knew me, and they were always happy to have something from the flask, and it always made my visit welcome, even if having the vicar call wasn't what they always expected. And I tried to get a bottle, and the barman on the Norland said, "Oh, no, sorry, we can't sell bottles, we can only sell tots. We've been told we can't sell bottles." Obviously, concern about drunkenness. So I said, well, how many tots in a bottle, and sell me that number of tots, and if you can leave the bottle around it, that'll be fine. And he wasn't sure about that. But the problem was solved by Robert Fox, who was then, I think, the BBC reporter, who, not being a soldier, was allowed to buy a bottle of whiskey. So he bought the bottle of whiskey for me and then gave it to me. And so I was able to add the whiskey to my pack and my hip flask before we went ashore. I'd also asked... Well, I hadn't been too bothered about it, but curiously enough, H had insisted that I took three or four small wooden crosses, a couple of feet high, ashore with me, so that in the event of casualties, we'd actually got these crosses. I thought it was totally unnecessary. I thought that was really not at all needed. But for some reason, H was adamant. So I went to the pioneers and said, I want a couple of collapsible crosses, which basically amount to two bits of wood with the shorter one with a couple of nails through the middle. And they thought this whole thing was a bit macabre and a bit pessimistic, but they produced them. So I shoved them in my pack as well. And really then just started organising the service we were going to have that evening before we landed, and just got round the companies just to talk to people and see how they were. We were then told that nobody was to go on the upper deck as we approached the island, though I've got to admit that I did go onto the upper deck as we passed Fanning Head. I went to the upper deck with one of the snipers who'd looked through his night sight at the islands and got the fright of his life when he saw what he thought were infrared sources all over the island. And he became immediately convinced that these were Argentine night viewing devices that were watching us approach the island. In the event, it turned out to be some quirk of rock formation that in the night sights produced this effect on his starlight night scope. But it was nice. I got out onto the deck and for the first time I could smell land, and this was for a long time that we'd been at sea, and I thought it was an absolute clear night by now, the day having been really overcast and drizzle, heavy sea. It was absolutely flat calm, clear night, and the islands looked, I thought, very beautiful as we passed into Falkland Sound. I then went back inside the ship and we simply sat on our packs and waited, with then an interminable drag down onto the ship's car deck with packs that really were far, far too heavy. I suspect nobody was carrying less than 80 pounds, and some of our soldiers would have been carrying over 100 pounds. It was just so heavy. Partly because we didn't know when we'd have a resupply, so we took everything that we thought we'd need with us. And of course, once soldiers had added ammunition to their packs, it really had become a heavy burden. I carried as much saline fluid as I could, and other medical supplies. And I also got quite a large number of smoke grenades, because again, I anticipated that if I was doing casualty clearance, I would need the smoke to bring helicopters in. But certainly, I think the weight we were all carrying was more than was really sensible for what we were about. But at the time, we had very little option, not knowing what resupply we'd have. There was a great unknown area of what the Argentine reaction would be and how far that reaction would allow us to do what we thought we could do. So at least we were trying to be as self-sufficient as circumstances permitted. We gradually filed down onto the car deck. I mentioned Don Ellerby's message over the tannoy of the PA system. We were late getting into the landing craft. I think I wasn't aware at the time, but I subsequently heard one of our soldiers had fallen between the landing craft and the ship's side, and though he hadn't been lost, he had been recovered with a broken pelvis, and that had delayed things. But I'd certainly no great difficulty getting out of the side of the ship and into the landing craft. And I remember putting my pack on the deck of the landing craft and thinking it was going to be a cold journey. So I took my jersey out and put my jersey on, put everything else on top, including my waterproof, zipped up and sat down and waited. For some time we simply sailed in circles, presumably waiting for other landing craft to load. And as this was going on, I could hear one of the Royal Naval ships firing onto subsequently it turned out it was firing onto Fanning Head, and it seemed that the shells she was firing were going over us and onto Fanning Head, and although I couldn't see the bursts on Fanning Head, I could hear them very clearly. Once we set a straight course, it became obvious we were heading down San Carlos Water, and the journey, we were on the landing craft quite a long time. As we approached the landing place, I took off my waterproofs and I took off my jersey and put them back in my pack, and the word was passed down to make ready, so the rifles were cocked. Now, it had been made very clear to us when we were on the ship that when we made ready before going ashore, only rifles were to be cocked. Under no circumstances were automatic weapons to be cocked. And there was a gunner, I think from one of the blowpipe detachments, just in front of me, who tried to cock an SMG. The cocking handle slipped out of his finger and the weapon went off. And he fired a round into the deck, which was, of course, steel, so the round ricocheted out. Now, we heard the bang, and I immediately said, you know, anybody injured? And there was no reply, nothing said. Then a Marine came down the side of the landing craft, saying, who stopped that one? Who's injured? And again, there was no reply at all. Nobody fell over, nothing happened. So the whole thing was ignored. We grounded, the front went down. There was some chaos, some confusion, rather, chaos, over whether we should get out or not. We'd been warned that the danger with the landing craft when the ramp went down was that a swell could then lift the craft forward. And the hazard was, if you were on the ramp or have just stepped off the ramp, that you could be overrun by the ship being lifted forward. So there's some hesitancy in getting off. And the Marine Command out troops, I think, was ambiguous enough for soldiers who'd never heard it before for there to be no reaction. And then one of the company sergeant majors simply shouted, go. And we went ashore. Just down the ramp, water was about waist height. Got ashore, and it was pitch dark, couldn't see a thing, and there really was chaos. I gathered again subsequently that the company that should have landed on the left of the battalion landing area had landed on the right side, and they were trying to get off to their objective, which was to the left at San Carlos settlement, and that the company that had landed on the left was the lead company to go off to the Sussex Mountain, and they were trying to cut off down to the right. So we had two companies trying to go in opposite directions through the bulk of the battalion as it landed. I was looking for the regimental aid post, which was slightly easier to see because they had their Red Cross armbands, and the white just showed up slightly in the dark. And we found ourselves together, and we then simply waited until we moved off, which was some time. I was concerned that we'd got ashore wet, and that we had a reasonable distance to march, and no certainty that we'd ever be able to dry out. In the wait to move off, some soldiers took their boots off and changed their wet socks. I decided not to, because I wasn't convinced that we'd finished getting our feet wet. It was bitterly cold, and whilst a lot of soldiers sat and shivered, I opted to walk up and down and keep warm simply by moving up and down. Eventually we started moving again, and headed off towards Sussex Mountain, and after about 800 yards waded another stream, so I was happy I'd left my wet socks on. We had our first casualty really at the far side of the stream, and a mortarman who appeared to have collapsed from heat exhaustion. We left one of the medics with him and pushed on. And as daylight came, it was quite obvious we were going to be nowhere near our objective. We had another soldier who fell over and damaged his back. We carried him as best we could in a ground sheet, since we had no stretchers, and it was an absolute nightmare. Not only had we got him with his pack, his rifle, with our own packs, and carrying somebody on a ground sheet was virtually impossible. Eventually we realised that we couldn't get any further. So we put him down, and I went and saw Dave Woods, the adjutant, and by now it was really quite light, and I said we needed a helicopter to lift him out. There was a stream of helicopters, large helicopters, Sea King, and Wessex taking stores ashore at this time. So Dave said, well, you know, wave one down. Well, I tried, and I had much chance waving a helicopter down, as I didn't really one has in stopping a hurricane, and the best I got was a wave back from the loadmaster. So I went back to Dave Woods and said, look, we've got to do this properly. Put the, you know, request for a casualty evacuation in, which he did. And really, very quickly, a Wessex arrived, and we were able to shove this casualty into it. And away he went. I then caught up with the RAP, who, with the bulk of battalion headquarters, were digging in at the foot of Sussex Mountain. Whilst we were digging in, we heard a pucara, and immediately took cover, and I, for the first time, began to realise that what I thought was a deep trench was in fact totally inadequate for its purposes, should this aircraft attack us, even with machine gun fire. And I shared a trench with Mike Ryan, who was headquarter company commander, who was one of our more experienced officers, having served in Dofar. I think it was Dofar. Anyway, he'd been out in the Gulf, he'd some experience. And I simply sat in the bottom of the trench with my Bergen on the top of the trench behind me, in the hope that it would provide a bit more cover. In the event, no attack materialised, and I gathered the aircraft was shot down by an SAS patrol returning to our lines. Not long afterwards, having just joked that at least on this occasion we wouldn't have to fill in trenches when we left them, as we had to do on all exercises, we were told to move and to fill in the trenches. When I asked why we'd to fill in the trenches, it was because our mortar line was going to be in that area, and it was felt that open trenches would be too much of an indication to any Argentine aircraft that there perhaps were British troops in the area. About this time, we were overflown by a Mirage, which had what looked like a camera attached to the side. There was no attack developed, it simply flew over us. Though B Company had been attacked by this time by a Pucara, which machine gunned them without any effect. And indeed, I believe that was the aircraft that the SAS shot down, that we'd heard from the RAP when we were at the bottom of the hill. We continued up the hill, and it was very, very hard going. The packs were heavy. It was quite a long way, and the going underfoot was difficult. We then found that some of the light helicopters, the scouts, were helping us insofar as they were loading our packs on and taking them up the mountain and dumping them where our lead companies had now arrived. And this, at least, when they did this, didn't allow us to then move on a bit more easily, not having 80 pounds or so on our back. That was a great help. I'd actually, at one point, went back down the hill, having been told that there was a casualty down there. I went back to try to find him, to see again if we could get him moved, and had no success whatsoever in finding him. On my way back, I noticed two what appeared to be abandoned blowpipe missiles still in their containers, so I picked them up and carried them up the hill with me and dumped them off with the blowpipe detachment. But eventually we got to our positions on Sussex Mountain, hours later than we should, and there we dug in with A Company on one hill, D Company just up the hill from us, and B Company further around to our left flank. We dug in a good half a mile down the reverse slope, that's the regimental aid post, and perhaps 200 yards from us, at about the same contour, battalion headquarters established itself, with the CO, with his tactical headquarters and main headquarters co-located. And having dug in, we then stayed there, really, watched the Argentine aircraft attacks on the shipping, until we moved off to march down to Goose Green.
What do you remember about the sight of the ships being attacked by the Air Force?
It was all very new. We were very impressed. I was very impressed with the Argentine Air Force and their skill. I thought their actual flying capabilities were very impressive. Whilst we ourselves weren't attacked, we did... We did see the attacking on the ships, and a number of the aircraft flew over our positions both on the way in to attack the ships and on the way out. And of course, the soldiers treated this rather like a fairground. and an enormous amount of ammunition was expended at these aircraft. To some effect, there was, I think we were credited with shooting down one, and certainly I saw others that appeared damaged after they'd flown past us. It was almost unreal. I don't think we realised entirely the significance of the damage that was being done to the ships. Perhaps because it was Royal Naval ships that were being attacked, we realised that it couldn't go on, that every ship we lost was not helping our cause. But I think we were more conscious that sitting on the mountains doing nothing, we weren't actually contributing to the war effort, and we were losing to the weather. And that if it came to a war of attrition, the Argentines would win. There was no doubt about that. H was most concerned about this, and he was regularly down at brigade making noises about really that we should move on. We should get on and do things, and sitting there we were just losing men to the weather. So in a rather odd way we seemed very remote from the shipping. Antelope blew up and sank, and I remember seeing the flash in the sky when she blew up at night, which illuminated my basher entirely, and I just got a ground sheet over the top of my dugout, and my signaller, and I saw this flash through the ground sheet quite readily, and we got up, had a look out, saw the ship burning, and simply went back to bed. We didn't see the any value in staying up all night watching this ship burning down in the anchorage, but for the rest of that night we were lit up by the different on different occasions by the armaments on the ship exploding, and by daylight all that was left of Antelope was a great cloud of steam, with the bow and stern sticking out of the water, but it really didn't seem to be anything to do with us. The aircraft we shot at, but again there was an air of unreality. They weren't attacking us, we weren't on their target, so we didn't suffer that kind of attack, and they just presented targets rather in the way that a fairground target was presented, and soldiers simply let fly at them. We were perhaps more concerned when on one occasion it appeared that the Norland had been hit and we could see smoke coming from the Norland. And what had impressed us by this time was that the ship didn't need to look to be on fire to be actually fatally damaged. When the Antelope, I think the Antelope was burning, there wasn't a great, when she came into the anchorage, there wasn't a great deal to show on her that there was any damage. And a day or so later, she'd gone. So when we saw smoke coming from the Norland, we were a bit concerned that perhaps the fire on board was more serious than we'd expected. But I think, again, most of our concern there was because the Norland was a ship we knew, the kit we hadn't brought ashore with us was still on her, as was our quartermaster and his department, and, of course, the ship's crew, who by now we were very friendly with. So there was the personal feeling there. But in the event, we saw that she wasn't burning any more severely than she wasn't burning, and apparently I discovered sometime afterwards that the smoke was from some wreckage from an aircraft that had landed on the ship, and so our anxiety decreased. But I don't think we were really very very concerned at the loss of shipping. It didn't seem to make any great impact on us, other than insofar as any display of that kind would make an impact.
So I interrupted you with you saying about H being agitated about getting off Sussex Mountain. What happened to you next?
Yeah, H was fretting continually, and I think rightly so. The longer we stayed there, the more exposed we were to the elements and the more men we would lose to the elements. And really, within a matter of days, men were beginning to complain about feet that were getting painful. It was cold, it was wet. We dug a hole and it filled with water, even on the top of the mountains. And the routine, really, was one of changing socks daily, if and when you could, and wringing any wet socks out and putting them in your underpants to dry, and just doing a rotational basis on a 24-hour basis, if you could. But H wanted to get on, and every time I saw him, he was champing at the bit and wanting to get on. Nearest Argentina down at the blue screen, let's go and at least brass them up, was his general theme. And at least we'll find out what quality of men they are. Now, he'd asked me to go and see him not long after he'd joined the battalion at Ascension Island. And he talked to me about individuals in the battalion who were in sometimes key positions who he wasn't entirely convinced should remain there, given that we would be fighting. I thought he was wrong, and I told him so, and I said that he really should leave the people that were where they were, where they were. But I suggested that in some cases, because it involved individuals who weren't commissioned, he perhaps ought to talk to the quartermaster as well, Tom Godwin, and get his opinion. I'm sure we were right that the individuals were in the right place and the right individuals were in those places. No changes were made, and I think that proved wise. But talking to him, it became obvious that his view of things was that the history so far had been one of Argentines and British stopping fighting very soon, that the islands had been taken with an exchange of fire, certainly, but with very few casualties, that South Georgia had both been taken after a short fight and indeed by now had been recaptured after a short fight. And his view was that the islands would probably be recovered by whichever side won the first battle. That a short, effective fight with us winning might well be all that it needed for the remainder of the Argentine forces on the islands to collapse. And I think he therefore had in his mind the view that the first contact with the Argentines would be important from a variety of points of view, not least of all that it would probably dictate who the eventual winners were, and that it had to be an aggressive and vigorous attack which would probably meet initial resistance from the Argentines and then a collapse. But he was also concerned that our troop strengths were such that we couldn't afford to lose many men or units, and I think perhaps it was the thought of that that provoked him to his subsequent actions at Goose Green. But he was certainly keen to be moving, as I think was the three Paraceo, Hugh Pike. And we really did begin to wonder what we were doing there. I mean, clearly we were in defensive positions, but there was no move by any Argentine ground forces that caused us to actually have to do any defending. There may or may not have been Argentine patrols in and around our area. On different occasions, on different nights, there were sentries fired off rounds at what they thought were intruders. But no bodies were ever found, and there was nothing ever conclusive found in daylight. So whether the Argentines did actually put any patrols into our area or not, I don't know. The Marines, I think, picked up one or two Argentine special forces, but